This is Dr. Charles Parker, and you're listening to Core Brain Journal. It's a place where I connect both fresh discoveries and interesting different perspectives from advanced mind science with the realities of real people and everyday life down on Main Street. Well, welcome aboard, folks. Dr. Charles Parker one more time, and we have a favored returning guest, the terrific Dr. Michelle Brown here. She was with us for an Alzheimer presentation earlier. Honestly, I should have looked it up. I didn't look it up. I'll have it in the show notes. The number. Do you remember what the number was on that?
Not offhand.
I don't either. I'm sorry. I'm bad. I should have prepared for that. I apologize. But it was such a wonderful meeting. I so much enjoyed meeting you and talking with you. I'm going to do a little intro in just a second. I'm going to tell people about our sponsors real quickly, and then we'll have another break later on. But then after the sponsors, I'll do a brief intro. Welcome, Michelle, by the way. Thank you so much for coming on board.
Thank you for having me.
So what we're going to do here, folks, is tell you a little bit about two partner sponsors. You listeners already know how much we love the reality of data here at Core Brain Journal. And today we welcome our clinical friend and our new sponsor partner, Direct Health Access Laboratory. With over 3 million studies, they are deep leaders of experience with a big picture of measuring, for example, methylation, cryptopyrrole, and copper challenges that directly affect brain function. They provide a global service, even in Nigeria, with a molecular focus. Stay tuned. Great folks. And then we also have the Barry Robinson Center here in Norfolk. You know how much we appreciate detailed improvements of mind care. And today we're pleased to welcome this other additional sponsor and partner with a deep interest in fresh options to address the complexity of adolescent treatment failure, both nationally and internationally. For 80 years, the nonprofit Barry Robinson Center teams in Norfolk, Virginia, have provided residential care on an evolved family, interpersonal, and again, a global level. And one thing about them, they are built TRICARE friendly. So welcome aboard to Barry Robinson Center. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and tell you all about our guest, Dr. Michelle Brown. She is a Yale and Harvard trained board certified neuropsychologist. You will love the way she talks. She's a brain health expert who lives in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. She is very passionate about empowering individuals to boost brain health and reduce the risk of Alzheimer's, and has been featured nationally on PBS, Fox TV, radio, and various print media. Dr. Brown previously served as the Assistant Director of Inpatient Mental Health at the Boston VA, and she, my friends, has been an instructor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. She's here to share inspiring information about how to improve memory and reduce the risk of Alzheimer's. But you know what? That's the old intro. She's here. We're going to talk about Alzheimer's a little bit because we're talking about measuring it. Today, we're talking about neuropsychological testing and how it's frequently misunderstood, poorly perceived, and we're going to take it down to the street level so people can really understand what that ominous, foreboding neuropsychological word actually means. So Michelle, tell us a little bit about yourself in this regard, please.
Absolutely. Well, it's a joy to be back. I had such a blast the first time, and I'm so grateful to have the opportunity to talk about neuropsychological testing and how it became a passion of mine. It was interesting. I started out as an undergrad in cello performance and ended up getting a degree in cello performance. And along the way, fell in love with psychology as well and couldn't really decide how I was going to move about with my career. And after undergrad, decided to do a number of pre-med courses and was really on that pre-med track, and realized in that journey that I loved the medical side of the world, and then I also loved the psychological side of the world. Mm-hmm. And I loved the amount of time I could spend with individuals when discussing emotional issues, and knew that the typical physician workload wouldn't allow me to get really in depth to the degree that I hungered to go. Mm-hmm. And so I stumbled upon neuropsychological testing, and it was an interesting story as I was looking for research experience in graduate school. I happened to see a flyer right after I had gone to this neuroscience lab where I was told I would have to take rat brains and study them. And I thought, oh my gosh, how is that going to be applicable to people? And mm-hmm. so there was this beacon of light, you know, shining on the neuropsychology poster in the hallway. And that was the end, you know, as soon as I got involved in the neuropsychology lab, really, I fell in love with it and have loved it ever since and am passionate about educating people about it and promoting it.
Well, I think the one thing you and I were talking about a little bit offline, and we talked about it in the last interview, is that people don't really understand. I think a lot of physicians don't understand. I mean, how can you be a medical person in a medical community and not get what neuropsych actually is? It's almost like it's, unfortunately, I think neuropsychology sort of falls under the rubric of psychiatry, which is so often I say this too often, I'm going to be in trouble with somebody, but it's really a fashion show. You know, the labels are, you know, superficial. You're a brunette, you're a blonde, this is what we do with blondes, and I'll talk to you later, gotta go. And that is what's going on. The psychiatric community is evolving. I'm not running it down here, but right now the standard of care for everybody from family practice up that are writing for psych medications is woefully superficial and outdated. And so we need people like you. So go ahead. You were going to say something.
I was going to say, absolutely. It's a very topical kind of label-based understanding about what lies beneath someone's professional title, I think. And so I also agree that there's this perception that a neuropsychologist falls under the psychiatry side of the house. And I can understand to some extent why that develops, because we are clinical psychologists at baseline, and we're trained as clinical psychologists. And so a huge percentage of our training is with populations that are have psychiatric issues or compromise. And so that makes total sense from the root standpoint. But the advanced training piece, and that starts really in graduate school, and in some cases even in undergrad, is really about brain science. It's about behavioral neurology, statistics, normative data referencing, and psychometric assessment. And so it's got that real hard science piece. And that piece oftentimes kind of gets lost in the title of neuropsychologist. Mm-hmm. And people often think, oh, I'm going to go in and someone's going to talk to me about my past, or I'm going to be on a couch. And and they're very surprised when they come in and they see that this is really a medical process that they're going through, but it's a warm medical process with a person across from you who is really looking not only at the data from the testing, but your life in context. And it is the person in front of you that presents that context. And that's what's so fascinating.
Well, and I think the words you were using are so helpful and useful, because metrics is what we're so interested in here at Core Brain Journal. Because, you know, if you're going to change your mind, details matter. And you can't just go at it with a brush and a cookie cutter. Hey, here's a label. Let's take a shot at it. And I'm looking forward to hearing the nuances from you about some of the things that a person can do with neuropsychological testing that make it really much more part of the scientific medical community than really everyday psychiatry is. Psychiatry is working to get there, but it's not there. I think in many respects, neuropsychology is far ahead of psychiatry, because it's going to hit the psychological piece, but it's also going to hit the neurologic brain function piece as well, without having to do a brain scan. You know, brain scans are now in the range of $5,000. And, you know, and even then what happens is you get down to the molecular cellular physiology, and very frequently you don't get down to the actual functional results. What you get is a picture of blood circulation under certain circumstances, which is still imprecise. It has a measure. SPECT imaging is useful. I've done SPECT imaging since 2003. I'm not running it down. I'm grateful for the time that I had doing SPECT imaging. But I think the science is moving past superficial appearances. Now, it's not superficial. You can say, how can you say SPECT imaging is superficial? It's not superficial compared to looking at a person from the outside, but it is superficial compared to neurophysiology and what's actually going on with brain function. So let's take a moment to tease that apart, if you will, and say some of the things that you found in your experience that are perhaps misunderstood or not fully recognized applications of neuropsychologic testing.
Yeah, and you hit on the core area right there with your statement about brain imaging, because that's really the biggest misconception, is that you can somehow get a look, a valid look at how a brain would function based on how it looks at a structural level. And there are some situations, if there is a core pathology that's significant, like a stroke or a tumor, where certainly if you look at a scan, you can surmise, you know, if you're seeing a left frontal tumor, for example, you can surmise that perhaps there would be expressive language issues. There are, in other words, there are major conclusions that can be drawn from major structural issues. But for the majority of individuals, 99.9% of people who come in do not have those structural issues that are not already known. When they come in, those are typically known if they exist for the person. Mm-hmm. What isn't known and what can't be really surmised with an image is, as you said, the functioning. So neuropsychology looks at the software of the brain. And it is looking at how are the different systems running? How are they functioning? Different systems meaning memory, attention, intellectual functioning, speed of information processing, motor functioning as well, visual spatial functioning, language functioning. And all of those functions I mentioned can really be broken down into their core parts. So, for example, under the domain of language functioning, you might look at expressive language or one's ability to speak. We might look at receptive language or one's ability to understand or comprehend. We can look at reading, spelling, math, all of the different areas that require intact language functioning. And if we're finding a chink in the armor somewhere along that line, what we do with our other tests is really see, are we seeing a global pattern, a geographical pattern, for example, where we're localizing that this specific area or this circuit of the brain seems to be problematic, something that, again, can't be picked up on the imaging. So neuropsychology is used not only for diagnosis of a cognitive disorder, by really getting specific about what specific areas and skills might be impaired, but also for prognosis. It's just crucial to have the correct diagnosis to know from a prognosis standpoint where we're going to be going over time. Neuropsychology is also the gold standard treatment when it comes to measuring treatment effects on cognition. So, for example, it's common to have neuropsychological testing given prior to epilepsy surgery to help locate where, for example, that surgery will take place, to have it after the surgery to see were we right in our estimates that removing this tissue would indeed not impact language or memory, and then down the road for monitoring of that person's cognitive functioning. So it's an exceptional tracking device. We can use that to track not only surgical, pre-surgical and post-surgical procedures, but even in chemotherapy. So, for example, prior to chemotherapy, we're getting more and more referrals from oncologists that recognize that chemotherapy can, in some cases, impact cognitive functioning. And by looking at that baseline pre-chemotherapy data and comparing it post-chemotherapy, we can see, are there effects from the actual chemotherapy itself, and pick up on those effects earlier, which can really give a lot of feedback to patients. Dementia is another area that we can help to monitor treatment effects in with memory medications that we might say, okay, let's give this one a try and see how it works. And over time, we might see, for example, that an individual shows a little bit more slowing in their memory change or decline on a certain medication than they might on a different one. So the measurement of treatment effects is another core piece of the evaluation. And also, importantly, one thing that's surprising to people is neuropsychological testing helps to determine whether the responses one is giving are actually valid. In other words, there's plenty of situations in which people are either knowingly or unknowingly presenting with cognitive symptoms that we need to determine, are those actually objective symptoms that truly exist due to a brain disorder, or are those symptoms that perhaps have more of a psychiatric basis or perhaps a secondary gain basis? And we actually have tests that allow us to see and detect changes in one's ability to actually participate in the evaluation, to look at their effort. So there's lots of different ways that neuropsychological testing can be used as a tool aside from just what we think of as diagnosis. And recovery and rehabilitation planning is another core way that we use it as well. For example, in stroke, we get a sense of how those cognitive functions are looking. And then we decide, how can we set up the most ideal remediation plan? Because time is of the essence in those situations. Traumatic brain injury, same situation. So it can be used at many different time points along a continuum, and it can really be optimal in diagnosing, tracking. It's a prognostic tool. It's a tool that gives us a sense of the validity of the actual measure itself.
Well, let me run back because there are two things I wanted to ask you. And first of all, I want to explain something for the audience, because when Dr. Brown was talking about secondary gain, she didn't use the word malingering, but that would be something that a person would want to know. Is that person truly damaged, or are they looking for some way to get something out of what looks like a damage, which really isn't a damage? But the other thing, and the reason I jumped in right here, is because you used the word prognosis a second time. And I wanted to, and I don't mean to put you on the spot, but I'd like to tease that apart with an example, if you could, because it'd be instructive to me, I'm sure, as well as the listeners. Give us an example of how some testing could be used that would then give you a certain result that would have a certain prognostic significance for the future of that person.
Sure. Probably the most common one we see is the differential diagnosis of dementia, because when there is a core memory issue, there can be literally dozens of underlying reasons why that would be. And if we don't get the cause right, and we don't delve in and understand, is this, for example, Alzheimer's? Is this a Lewy body dementia? Is this a frontotemporal dementia? Is this a reversible dementia? For example, just last week, I saw an individual with normal pressure hydrocephalus, who, if we don't get that right on the front end, that person is going to continue having decline that could be potentially reversed. Is this an encephalopathy or an acute brain issue that is due to an underlying metabolic problem? For example, interestingly, about a month ago, I saw a case of Hashimoto's encephalopathy.
That's totally interesting.
It's very interesting. And so that's another example where if we're not really honing in and getting the etiology or the cause correct on the front end, and that's not always as easy to do if you don't understand that this is maybe an acute problem versus something that we would expect to worsen over time or a chronic issue. And so those types of differentiations on the front end put us in a whole different trajectory. So, for example, the patient I mentioned with hydrocephalus, he had a spinal tap last week, and he's going to be shunted the next couple of days. And already after the spinal tap, he has shown clinical improvement in his urinary functioning, and also we were able to look at, for example, some measures of cognitive functioning that improved directly after the pressure was reduced. So that's a great example of how we need to get that right on the front end so that person is set up to improve as much as possible.
Yeah, so let's just take a moment to clarify that, because you and I know what hydrocephalus is, but some of our audience may not know. I think it's terribly interesting because we're doing brain imaging. What happens is, and you tell us a little more about how you actually measure that, but you can actually see the ventricles, which house the cerebral spinal fluid in the brain, actually enlarge. Something happens inside wherein that cerebral spinal fluid builds up inside the brain and pushes the brain like a balloon outside against the skull, while inside the cerebral spinal fluid accumulates. Now what has, and of course you can have a kind of dementia, you have other things, you can have a motor gait problem, you can have urinary incontinence. But the real issue then for me, asking a person like yourself who's doing measuring, is how in the dickens on a test can you see something like that? It doesn't make any sense to an innocent like myself.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'll also be happy to share with you how the testing changed, because this is a great example of someone who, when he came in, he was showing the clinical triad, first of all, that you mentioned. So he had some urinary incontinence, he had some gait changes that were fairly sudden onset, and he had some confusion. And he actually was an individual I saw previously who had a vascular dementia when I met with him a year ago. So we had some baseline data from that. And so how we see pressure effects on neuropsychological testing are in reduced motor speed, reduced attentional functioning, mm-hmm. reduced learning of information. And what we see when that pressure is relieved is an increase in the functioning, those functions bounce back a little bit. So, for example, within the space of about a week and a half, his finger tapping score, which is how rapidly he can tap a key in 10 seconds, that improved by almost 50% after he was after his lumbar puncture. So, and his attentional scores improved. His ability to do a measure of visual spatial functioning, rapid visual processing improved. So when we see as a neuropsychologist that those cognitive variables that are impacted by pressure appear to be more impaired than areas that are not as impacted by pressure, like language skills, like memory retention abilities, we see those patterns, that starts to fit with the clinical pattern we're seeing in front of us. And then we say, let's take a closer look at that. And sure enough, you know, the open question was the spinal tap going to help him? And he got symptomatic improvement from it.
So then talk a little bit and tell us about the shunting business. I know you're not a neurosurgeon, but on the other hand, could you tell our audience a little bit about shunting and what happens with that and the surgery and so on, and how a person can fix hydrocephalus?
Sure. My understanding is in this situation, it's going to be what's called a ventriculoperitoneal shunt. So it is going to be inserted into the ventricles, the fluid-filled spaces in the brain that you mentioned, and it will drain excess cerebrospinal fluid into the peritoneal area. And there are a couple of different kinds of shunts. Some have the ability to be calibrated over time and to be changed in terms of their calibration, and then some don't. And I'm not sure exactly what type he will get, but it's a relatively straightforward procedure. And the important thing to know is that I would say he is one of only two patients over the last 10 years that I've seen that we actually have seen clinical improvement from after a lumbar puncture. In other words, a lot of times by the time normal pressure hydrocephalus is detected, it's been on board for so long that the clinical improvement is minimal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've seen one person get better quick like that. I haven't had a lot of experience with it because I think I saw three people in remembering, and one person was just unable to get out of bed and had all of the triad and was out of bed in a very short period of time. Mm-hmm. And it was really quite striking because you thought the person was pretty well dead, stroked, whatever. Something had happened and it was inexplicable. And then the neurosurgeon did a good job and got it turned around.
It's amazing to see that, because in our business, we don't tend to see that kind of rapid improvement and turnaround. And so it's really gratifying to play any role in that.
Well, listen, let's take a quick break here for a second, and we'll do a little bit of sponsor in the middle. I have some questions that I want to ask you. I'll get you prepped for them right now. I think an interesting thing for our audience is, what are the differences between neuropsychological individuals, professionals? How can you assess a person if you need to get some kind of testing done? So that's something I'll ask you about in just a moment. We'll be back in just a second. Well, folks, you know as well as I do that psychiatric treatment failure, especially after multiple medication trials and those very, very brief hospitalizations, may prove insufficient to deal at home with the complexity of troubled children and those adolescents from 6 to 17 years old. Improved care, those next mandatory steps, should include a more comprehensive approach to address those multiple levels of challenges, from family to peers to school, diagnostically from defiance to depression, on every level for families, including military families internationally. The Barry Robinson Center's 32-acre open college-like campus in Norfolk, Virginia, provides safety and security and clean, comfortable living. How do we know? We refer folks over there all the time, strongly endorse what they're doing. So for further information and informed interview, connect at this page, barryrobinson.org/core. Well, you folks already know that here at Core Brain Journal, we're on a mission to introduce you to resources that make significant contributions to the investigation of those predictable mind science applications. Our colleagues at DHA Lab Group provide a real difference with treatment options for people at every level, from first awareness of mind problems to those frustrating times when even well-informed treatment becomes surprisingly unpredictable. For my entire professional life, from psychoanalysis to brain scans, I've searched for, yes, improved predictability. The good news for all of us, from professionals to patients, remarkably effective research offers useful, cost-effective, organic options far beyond guesswork with psychiatric medications alone. DHA lab tests measure unbalanced biomedical details through easily available testing, now available globally for a variety of molecular answers from, for example, methylation, copper, and cryptopyrrol challenges. Check in for more details at dhalab.com core. That's dhalab.com/core. Okay, welcome back, folks. We have just taken a little break, and we're going to go back to Dr. Michelle Brown. And what we want to do now is ask, how does a person shop up a neuropsychologist? Because it seems so arcane in the first place. We're over the intimidation of the word. We know that they do something really remarkable and scientific. Then how do you understand what the qualifications are of a person when you're asking about their professional abilities?
So a neuropsychologist, first of all, is someone who has attained a master's degree and a doctoral degree in psychology or neuropsychology. And so that's the first most important thing to verify, because the title is not necessarily always protected depending on what state one is in. So at a minimum, what you're looking at is
great. Now say that again. You broke up. You said at a minimum what you're looking at, and right there we had a little glitch in the airwave. So if you could repeat that, please. Sorry to interrupt.
No problem. So what you're looking for at a minimum is that level of training where an individual has a master's and then a doctoral degree in clinical psychology or neuropsychology. And typically that's followed by 1 year of internship and 1 to 2 years, preferably 2 years of a fellowship, a postdoctoral fellowship in neuropsychology. There is a guideline. It's called the Houston Guidelines. It's something that our profession uses to really get a sense of all of the different requirements along the way for training, and that then feeds into the board certification process. So that would be the second thing to look for, is board certification. And the leading board in the United States is the American Board of Professional Psychology, which has neuropsychology as one of 13 or 14 subspecialties. And that's then overseen by the American Board of Clinical Neuropsychology. And so there are other certifying neuropsychology boards as well, but that's the other piece you're looking for, is that board certification, similar to a physician. When we're looking at physicians, we tend to also look for, has that person acquired the appropriate training, and are they board certified? I should add that a number of neuropsychologists who are very competent may also not have board certification. Mm-hmm. So really, it's not as if someone doesn't, they're not a competent person mm-hmm. or a practitioner. We know that it's an increasing phenomenon over these last few years that more and more individuals are becoming board certified, partially because that's more of a requirement in our healthcare systems. Mm-hmm. So I do want to give a shout out to people who may not have that credential, but also may have all of the experience necessary. But that's the quickest way that a consumer can really get a sense. And there are locators. For example, on the American Academy of Clinical Neuropsychology website, you can go to that website and there's a locator for you to find in your state who are mm-hmm. the board certified neuropsychologists under that board.
So that's great. Now, let me ask you another question that we got the qualifications of the person. We're looking for somebody. And the problem I'm going to ask you about now is, we've talked a little bit about Alzheimer's in the previous conversation, and you did a really good job of talking about implications for health and brain health there. But another broad spectrum of individuals that might have some, I don't know the answer to this question, so I'm not leading it anywhere, prognostic significance would be individuals, kids, children, who have a couple things, either a biomedical illness of some kind or autism. Mm-hmm. Now, do neuropsychologists, we haven't customarily in my practice, obviously, that's why I'm asking the question, used neuropsychologists with autistic individuals? And so tell us a little bit about that application, if you will, please.
Absolutely. That's wonderful to talk about, because that opens up the whole realm of pediatric neuropsychologists and then adult-focused neuropsychologists. Pediatric neuropsychologists tend to see individuals with autism at a much higher rate than the adult neuropsychologists. Mm-hmm. And pediatric neuropsychologists are instrumental in helping with early diagnosis of autism. And there are a number of behavioral signs clinically that, as you know, are important to look at. But then there are also cognitive profiles that are more common in autistic children. And so looking at the combination of those factors can oftentimes help set a child up for early intervention at an even earlier stage than we might use by just looking at clinical indicators alone. Mm-hmm. I do see individuals who are on the adult side who, again, have autism, but again, that diagnosis is typically made many decades before, and so they're usually coming in for some other issue. Mm-hmm. But the bread and butter of the autism focus is really in the pediatric realm, typically in medical centers as mm-hmm. part of multidisciplinary teams.
So then what about metabolic comorbid conditions? For example, you know, we have like an early type 1 diabetes, for example. Some of the other medical conditions do have cognitive disarray and may have some need to be measured and corrected.
That is an area that we see several times a week. I'm so glad you brought that up, because the metabolic impact on cognitive functioning is something that is so important to focus on. And we've been really trying to outreach to cardiologists and to lipidologists and to others who are innately involved in that, and really spread the word that what we typically see in those individuals are more of what we call a subcortical or a vascular profile on their cognitive testing. Mm-hmm. For example, they are tending to have more difficulties with speed of information processing, speed of motoric processing, all of those functions that are fed by those tiny capillary beds that can get interrupted by some of those metabolic factors. We tend to see a memory profile that's pretty specific to vascular disease. For example, an individual may have difficulty retrieving information that they just learned, but if you give them cues, recognition cues, and you say, did I say this word, yes or no, they're generally going to be a lot stronger on that type of memory than their retrieval memory. And the reason for that is because they were able to encode the information. They're just having difficulty as a result of that underlying vascular issue retrieving it. I think of it as a fishing line. The frontal lobe is trying to send back that fishing line to reel in that word, and it's sometimes hitting some of those areas that have been impacted by the vascular problem. And so they need a cue. They need you to give them the fishing line and go, did I say this, yes or no? And then oftentimes, again, that ability to say it in a valid way is there. So that is something we tend to see, and that's actually a big risk factor for Alzheimer's as well. Are those vascular risk factors, diabetes, high cholesterol, hypertension, big risk factors.
And you can see it happen. So, and one of the things I think is so interesting about cognition, and you know this so much better than I do, is timing. I mean, I see it clinically. Time is a reality that's not in the current diagnostic coding system for us over in psychiatry. And time is a reality that's absolutely foundational for anything that you're looking at in the human condition, because if you don't evaluate cognition, you're just not even doing 50% of the job. I mean, that's at least 50% of what we do. And if you think about humans adapting to natural change and just managing their lives successfully, it's more than 50%. Go ahead, you were going to say something.
I was going to say that's so huge, because what we do when we talk about these metabolic and vascular issues is we bring on the big, amazing force of what we call positive neuropsychology, which is focused on cognitive health. And that's why we try to outreach so much to those cardiologists and primary care physicians and say, let's look at the cognitive impact of these chronic diseases. Because when we tell an individual that by controlling blood pressure or by controlling cholesterol, you're helping decrease your risk of Alzheimer's, that has a totally different weight and motivation for that individual. And so that's part of what I love about it, is that this assessment takes life for this person in a totally new way. And it really empowers that person to think, geez, if my 3-pound brain every minute that goes by is taking about three cups of blood every minute, which is astounding, which is about 25% of what the heart is beating, I need to take care of that blood. I need to take care of everything in that blood. Mm-hmm. So when they see it in that frame, it makes such a difference for them.
Mm. So interesting. So how's the application in your life? You specialize in doing neuropsych testing. So yeah. Do you do that all day, every day? I mean, with all the excellent education you've had, do you do teaching as well? Or what's your professional life like?
I do 90% of my day is spent doing neuropsychological testing and evaluations. Mm-hmm. And about 10% of the time is spent outreach, in outreach like I'm doing now, mm-hmm. and doing presentations and mm-hmm. teaching. And I really want to spread the word in as many ways as possible, and feel like when I get to work with individual patients, it's very gratifying, but I really want to share that information as much as I can. And so mm-hmm. I'm so grateful to have, you know, conversations like this so that we can get the word out.
Well, I feel the same way, because I think meeting individuals like you and really looking at a comprehensive approach to human functioning and really brain functioning, really it's, but I don't like to say just brain function, it's the entire comprehensive organism. How's that person managing their lives? Where are they going to go? Instead of, hey, here's a psychiatric diagnosis. I mean, bringing the insights that you have, the really deep insights, the nuances of how we actually function in our lives, really a big deal, and I really do appreciate it. It's really great having you on. Let me ask you a personal question.
Sure.
Because my son-in-law plays the cello. Do you still play the cello?
Not as much as I'd like. It was one of those things that I was eating, breathing, and sleeping for years. And so it feels like I've still been just kind of taking a hiatus, but it's a gorgeous instrument. As you know, it's closest in range to the human voice. And so there's something very visceral about mm-hmm. that sound. Mm-hmm. And it's just, an amazing experience to play it and be a part of an orchestra as well. So I'm so happy to hear that.
Oh, that would be fun. That would be fun. Yeah, he's from Germany, so managed to get his instrument over. I can't remember the nuances of how they did it, but he's very good at it and he's practiced a lot. But he's a German shipbuilder. He works on mega yachts in up in Maine. So he's got that whole craftsman thing going on. It's really quite interesting, which is what you're doing.
Yeah, he's a renaissance man, it sounds like.
Yeah, he is. Well, and you're a renaissance woman. You've got the craftsman thing going on, and you have a variety of capacities like that. Really serious contribution. So listen, tell us how we can get in contact with you in closing here. What would be your website? Of course, I'm going to have it on the show notes, and I'm going to go over the entire recording here and put some highlights on, because it's been such an interesting conversation. But if you tell us where to send people, that'd be a great thing. We can connect with you in another way.
That would be great. So I'm at www.drmichellebraun.com, and that's drmichellebraun.com. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, good. Well, thank you very much, Michelle. It's just been great talking to you again. If you have any kind of remote idea about talking about, I just like talking to you because I learn so much as we go along. I mean, that whole autism thing was interesting to me. I mean, I should know more about it. I'm a little overconfident with autism because I just feel like I know it, so I don't send people to get tested for it.
Sure.
But I think it's absolutely relevant. There's so many people who are wondering about, is it or is it not? And here's a vehicle for finding out, making an identification, and having a treatment goal. Here's what the problem is. Let's see if we can fix it.
Yeah, exactly. And I would add too that you speak to something that's really powerful, which is, even if you have that clinical expertise to make that diagnosis correct all the time, that the added value then of the neuropsychological testing is it gives you, like you said, that metric to track. Yeah. So what are we seeing? Where are the gains, and how can we titrate the treatment then based on the gains we're seeing?
Absolutely. That is it's so relevant. We do the same thing with laboratory testing all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, we test for cryptopyrrole or copper. They're so relevant in brain function. And yes, we repeat the lab test. I mean, it's as simple. We've got to see what's going on. So thanks so much again, Michelle, for taking the time. I really appreciate you spending time with us, and we'll do it again sometime.
I'd love to.
Thank you very much. You have a good one, girl.
All right, you too.
Thanks for listening to Core Brain Journal. We're working every day behind the scenes to bring you reports that connect research benches with those street trenches. Here we share the complexity of mind science because, as you know, details really do matter. One of the most pervasive, misunderstood challenges is how commonplace medications, like those written for ADHD, are used so regularly without clear guidelines. If you think you'd like more specifics, take a minute to download my 2-page PDF packed with video links and references on the absolute essentials of how to start ADHD medications. They're easily available at corebrainjournal.com/start. Thanks for listening. Do connect and stay tuned. Together we can make a difference.